WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Our next guest, George Clooney, has a new movie out today, Michael Clayton, in which he plays an attorney at a high-priced, low-ethics law firm. Clooney rose to stardom in the TV series ER. His father, Nick Clooney, was a TV newsman, which helped provide some of the inspiration for his son's film, Good Night and Good Luck, the story of CBS newsman Edward R. Murrow. Clooney's aunt, Rosemary Clooney, was a famous singer of standards and popular tunes. Terry spoke with George Clooney in 2005 and asked what his aunt's music meant to him.
What did her music mean to you when you were growing up? It was not your generation.
No, but I was one of those weird kids, you know. I was listening to...
It wasn't my generation either.
No, that's right. Well, I was listening to Led Zeppelin and I was listening to Nat Cole. You know, I had a very varied growing up because I was on the road with, you know, with them a lot, or I was always exposed to...
Were you
to...
on the road with Rosemary Clooney?
Yeah.
No, I mean with Led Zeppelin? Wait, who were you on the road?
Oh, yeah, exactly. With Led Zeppelin. No, I was on the road. When I was 20, I was Rosemary's driver.
Oh, you know? Right. I see. Yeah.
So I was around that kind of music a lot.
Yeah.
So I got to appreciate Cole Porter and Johnny Mercer. I had a real appreciation of those guys. Sinatra and, you know, Nat King Cole especially, and Rosemary. And Rosemary was having, she was having her comeback at that point. And her comeback was something rather spectacular because she became the singer's singer. Singers adored her and would show up. So there was a great pride in being around her. So I was really exposed to that kind of music. I remember asking Rosemary why she's a better singer at 70 than she was at 21 because she couldn't hold the notes the way she could. She couldn't hit the notes the way. And she said, because I don't have to prove I can sing anymore. And I thought that was a good acting lesson, you know, was... not having to show off anymore.
I know exactly what she was talking about, too, because her voice was basically shot in the last couple of recordings she made, but her phrasing was so beautiful and the emotion was so beautifully conveyed in it.
When you see her taking songs that are normally sort of up-tempoed, like Don't Fence Me In, or... And bringing it down to like a quarter of the speed and singing, you know, Straighten Up and Fly Right. It's amazing.
You stayed with your aunt when you first got to Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like she threw you out after a while.
Pretty much, yeah. I understand that. I would have thrown me out.
How come?
Well, I think at some point you don't need a 22-year-old kid hanging around in your house anymore. I'm sure I was a pain. At some point, I'm sure, you know, the idea of offering your nephew to come out and live with you is a nice gesture, but I think it comes back to haunt you after about a year, you know.
Yeah. Did you think you were talented when you started working? Did you think you actually had something?
I didn't really know whether I had any talent or not. I knew that I was, for the first time in my life, engaged. I was 20 years old, 21 years old, and didn't really have any great objectives. I wasn't going to be a great newsman. I'd studied journalism. I'd done a few news pieces, but I wasn't bright enough or curious enough to do news, especially on the level that my father was doing it. And I was certainly going to be compared to my father. And then I found acting and I thought, well, this is something that at the very least I'm not going to be bored by. And I got into an acting class pretty quickly and I started working with working actors. And, you know, there's an assumption before you actually become part of the acting community that people who work are good actors and people who don't are bad actors. It's just sort of an assumption. And what you realized was you'd be doing a scene and you'd be holding your own with someone who's making a very good living acting. You'd realize that there's a possibility that you can actually do this for a living. So it was a long process of figuring out whether or not I was any good at it. And it's still a long process of figuring that out.
Well, ER, when you got ER, that certainly must have changed your life a lot. I mean, suddenly you were a star and people become so close to you when you're on TV every week.
Yeah.
There's this kind of bonding that I think people go through.
It's an unusual experience because it's not like being a movie star. You haven't paid $10 and you're 30 feet high and you've made it a date. You know, you've been in their homes every Thursday, so... You know, the truth is I'm a product of a great amount of luck. I create some of that luck because, you know, I did 13 pilots and I did 8 television series before that. But the simple truth is, had I done that exact same show and that exact same role, and we were on Friday night instead of Thursday night at 10, I don't have a film career, and I'm not sitting here with you. It requires that kind of luck. The show would never have been as popular on a Friday night as it was on a Thursday night.
You knew something about fame. You know, your father was on TV. Rosemary Clooney, your aunt, was incredibly famous. But what surprised you most when it happened to you? What were you unprepared for?
Well, it's a funny thing. There isn't a real fame school that you can go to and learn, you know. I had probably, if there was anybody, you haven't met many people better prepared for it, because I had the great vision of watching, especially with Rosemary, how big you can get and how quickly it can be taken away. Mm-hmm. And it's not like Rosemary became less of a singer in that period of time, which showed me that it has very little to do with you. And you still have that. I still have the idea that that goes away at some point, as it does, sooner or later. And when it does, that's why you direct and you write and you try to have other coals in the fire. But the things that you aren't prepared for are the trade-offs. No one wants to hear you complain about them, so you don't complain about them. But I would say that the significant loss of privacy is interesting.
One of the things you've done was try to take on one of the tabloid news shows, mm-hmm. Hard Copy. What provoked you to take a stand and try to tone down the aggressiveness with which the tabloid shows were coming after stars?
Well, I thought it was, I've always dealt with things because I'm the son of a journalist. I thought I had a journalistic argument, which I did, which was that if, it all started in sort of a silly moment. I was sitting eating dinner with a girl, and somebody had a video camera on the table next to us, and they propped it up on a cork and videotaped it. And the next night, that conversation that I was having with this girl in private at a restaurant was on Hard Copy. And I said, okay, fair enough. I'm going to say you're allowed to do that, even though I think it is an infringement of privacy. Let's just say I'm a public figure, so fair enough. Everything's fair game. However, somebody took that video and Hard Copy bought it. And Hard Copy was owned by Paramount, who also owned
Entertainment Tonight.
Entertainment Tonight. So I called up Entertainment Tonight and I said, listen, I'm not going to do any more of your shows, which you use me to make money and then use that money to buy these videos from these guys. That seems like a fair argument. And a guy named Frank Kelly, who was running the place at the time, said, I'll make you a deal. And I said, what's the deal? And he said, the deal is you'll never appear on Hard Copy if you just drop this right now. And I said, put it in writing. And he did, on Paramount letterhead. Now, this was right when they were putting the ratings on TV, and they thought it was going to be a big deal, you know, TV, PG, and stuff like that. And they thought it was actually going to be much bigger than it was. And everyone was trying to get a news rating, which meant there was a no rating. And Hard Copy was battling heavily to be a news show, which, of course, it isn't. It wasn't. It was an entertainment show. Battling, you know, it was Inside Edition with Bill O'Reilly, in fact, A Current Affair, Hard Copy, American Journal. Those shows were all sort of entertainment shows. So I had this piece of paper that said, we agree that you will never appear on our news show, Hard Copy. About 6 months later, there was this innocuous story, because it couldn't have been, if it was a explosive story, it would have just been me trying to defend myself for the story. It had to be an innocuous story. It was just a shot of me walking down the street with my girlfriend, but it was on Hard Copy. So I called, I sent the letter around and I said, first of all, you broke your promise. But more important than that is, I'm not sure you're allowed to call yourself a news organization and make this promise. I'm fairly sure you can't, in fact. And it ended up on the front page of a lot of newspapers, and they called it a smoking gun. And it ended up being sort of a fun fight. It was all journalistic fight.
When you were, I think, around 13, tell me if I'm wrong with the age, you got for about a year something called Bell's Palsy.
Yes.
And you could describe what it is for a second.
Well, Bell's, they're not quite sure what causes it. They think it's a inner ear virus. It's certainly something you catch. Most people, when your kids, usually takes about 6 months to go away. Sometimes people have it when they're older and it doesn't last quite as long. About 90% of the time it gets better, but it's complete paralysis in half of your face. Numb, complete, you know, eye patch, the whole thing.
So you were that way for about a year?
About 9 months, yeah.
Terrifying.
Well, when it first happened, because I'd just seen the movie Pride of the Yankees with Lou Gehrig, and he'd had Lou Gehrig's disease. You know, he came down at the end of the movie. And I remember I was sitting in church with my mom and dad, and my tongue was numb and the side of my face was numb. I was just starting high school, you know. It's not a great time for that anyway. And we went to Frisch's Big Boy, which is where you go to, you know, like Bob's Big Boy. It's one of these fast food restaurants where we would go after church. And I was drinking and the milk was pouring out of the side of my mouth. And I thought, oh, I've got Lou Gehrig's disease and I'm going to die. And you realize fairly quickly that it was Bell's palsy after I got into a doctor.
Then that naturally goes away on its own?
Yeah, there's nothing you can do about it.
Well, the reason why I ask is I've noticed that a lot of artists, writers, actors were disabled and sidelined during a part of their childhood by some kind of, you know, illness or another. And that they were forced to kind of stop doing certain activities and spend more time alone in their bedroom, doing whatever you do when you're a kid alone in your room. Did the Bell's palsy put you through a period like that? And did it change you at all? Did it make you...
Sure. Well, what it does is, it's a funny thing, but, you know, you got to remember that up until I was 13 years old, we moved. I went to 5 different grade schools. We moved a lot because my dad had a lot of different jobs. So going from, you actually develop either a good personality about being around people, or my sister had a tougher time with it. You're either comfortable or you're not about being around people. It makes it much more difficult when suddenly half your face is paralyzed and you're going into high school.
Yeah.
So what you become is the joker. It's probably a great thing that it happened to me, because it forced me to engage in a series of making fun of myself. And I think that's an important part of, it's an important part of being famous, by the way, which is, you know, you got to get yourself first. You have to, you know, the practical jokes have to be aimed at you. You have to be able to make fun of yourself a lot. I think that that's been one of the issues with some of the some of the liberal bend. Some of my friends, even at times, that take up the fight against Bush, is that they lack some humor, and because of that, it comes off as preaching. And I think that there's other ways of doing it. You know, the traitor issue is a perfect example. I'll give you the best example is, there was this magazine cover and it had, Sean Penn and Michael Moore and myself and Barbara Streisand and Susan Sarandon and Tim Robinson. It had a picture, not the Globe, but it was one of those magazines that said traitor across our chest. And I got a call from one of these actors. Not one of them, but another actor who I will keep nameless. But he called me and said, who was also on the cover, and called up and said, we have to hold a press conference and say that this is McCarthyism. This is, you know, you can't do this. And I said, look, you can't be talking about freedom of speech, which is what we're talking about, being allowed to say what we want, and then say, but don't say bad things about me. You got to take your hits. I said, let me handle it. Let me do one. And they said, okay. So I took that same cover of the magazine with the same pictures of us on it, and I found other people who were speaking out about the war, the Pope, Pat Buchanan, Bob Novak, Nelson Mandela, Jimmy Carter. I put them also on that, with traitor right across the Pope's chest. And I sent it to 800 news outlets anonymously with a thing underneath it that said, paid for by the citizens for a free Iraq, you know, I'm for a free Iraq. Folded up and sent it out anonymously and waited. And CBS and Entertainment Tonight eventually picked it up, and they called and said, have you seen this flyer that's going around? And I was waiting for that.
Was your name on it? Did they know it was from you?
No, it was completely anonymous. Uh-huh. So when they sent it out, my quote, Entertainment Tonight called and said, have you seen this flyer that's going around? And my quote was, the Pope and I can take it, but don't pick on Pat Buchanan. And the trick was, to me, the idea was, you got to do this with some humor. I mean, I remember Michael Moore called me up and he said, have you seen this flyer that's going around? And I said, that's me, Michael. I did that. And he goes, oh, okay, good. So the trick to me was that there had to be some humor to this, because we got to sort of, and you got to take the hits yourself a little bit.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
That was fun.
George Clooney speaking to Terry Gross in 2005. His new movie, Michael Clayton, opens today. This is Fresh Air.